joined once again on the Green by contributor Larry Nagengast, who this week revisits where things stand with public school reopening, school districts and charters. So Larry, we appreciate you continuing your dogged pursuit of these reopening plans.
Oh, I was thinking that, you know, this might be the last one that we write about reopening plans, but somehow I suspect that that's going to be wrong.
Well, you're probably right about that. We have said a few times now that there are a lot of different approaches across the state to handling reopening. Having now had a chance to really survey almost everyone, including the private schools last week, is there any common ground that's emerging as these plans really start to solidify on the public school side?
Well, on that point, let me start with a little mea culpa of my own. Last month, when we were talking about the guidelines that the State Department of Education had issued, I said it was possible that we could have 39 different plans, but I didn't think that that was likely. Well, from what I've seen this week, it sure does look like we've got 39 different plans, 19 from the districts and 20 from the charter schools. Even so, there is a lot of common ground. Certainly the pieces associated with wearing masks and using hand sanitizer and all the other health and wellness procedures are pretty similar across the board, and that's pretty much to be expected. There's also a lot of commonality in how the schools plan to reopen. About two-thirds of the school districts and more than half of the charter schools are opting for a virtual reopening, with all of the learning being done online and none in the classrooms. Most of these districts plan to transition to some sort of hybrid operation in mid-October. The other districts and charters are starting out in that hybrid format, meaning that some students will be in school while others learn online, but there's a great deal of variety in how those hybrid arrangements are being set up. Now, some of that variety is occurring as schools set their priorities for hybrid learning. In some schools, all students won't get the same amount of instruction. At the elementary level, the younger students, those who are still learning how to read, may get more time in the building than the older ones, who can be more independent. In some cases, priority for face-to-face instruction is going to be given to children with special needs or to those whose families don't have reliable access to the internet.
Now, last spring, when schools were thrown into remote learning, and it was very difficult to truly engage students, that was something that was a real problem. And it led to, you know, fairly limited efforts to hold students accountable. Is that going to change this fall? Is there going to be a little bit more effort to make sure students are engaged?
Yes, most definitely. There are going to be some changes made, and that's where having had the summer to plan rather than just being thrown into the online environment has really helped. Along with having time to develop class schedules and to tailor curriculum content for online delivery, schools have been able to set some standards. Now, students and their parents will know when they're supposed to log on for class, how homework assignments will be made, and when they're supposed to be turned in. And parents are being told that they've got some responsibilities too, like providing a supportive learning environment and monitoring students to make sure that they're doing their work. Schools are also going to be working harder to make sure that students are participating in getting their work done. The Colonial School District, for example, is transforming its group of visiting teachers and some of its support staff into something that it's calling a family crisis triage team. And what this group is going to do is when they find that kids aren't logging on to do their classwork, they're going to start making phone calls or even visiting homes, and they're going to dig into the situation, figure out what's going wrong, why the kid isn't on the computer, why he's not going to class, find the solutions, and get everybody, hopefully get everybody back on track.
You mentioned schedules and curriculum a little bit. Not all subjects are apparently created equal when it comes to this kind of new normal for learning. There are priorities, as you noted. Can you tell us a bit what the priorities are, how schedules are going to reflect that, and what's going to happen to subjects like art and music that maybe aren't top of mind for schools to make sure kids are engaged with?
Well, as one of the school leaders pointed out to me, when you're trying to shrink 6 hours of a regular school day down into four, something's got to give. Now, broadly speaking, educators have been looking closely at the curriculum, determining what are the most important skills and concept in each subject area, and giving those items the greatest emphasis. Instruction on less important items will be minimized and maybe even skipped altogether. Now, we do have different patterns emerging at the elementary and the high schools. In the elementary schools, there's going to be more intense focus on reading, English language arts, and math. Students can expect lessons in these subjects every day, whether they're in school or learning remotely, and the remote instruction will be synchronous, delivered in real time. There won't be as much time for the special classes like art and music, but they won't be overlooked entirely. They might get one of these classes a week, and it might be asynchronous, that is, recorded by the teacher so the student can watch it at a scheduled time later in the day. At the high school level, what's happening is that they're simplifying the scheduling. Instead of students taking six or seven classes with 45-minute periods per semester, they're probably going to be taking, in many cases, four classes with the class periods running an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half. And those classes are going to be essentially a full year's work into one semester. This is going to simplify the scheduling and make it give students the opportunity to study those areas in a little bit more depth and a little bit more concentrated period of time.
Your piece also notes that vo-techs are a different kind of animal. What are they doing?
Well, you know, with the vo-tech schools, hands-on career training is an essential part of the curriculum. You know, and it's pretty clear to you and me that if a plumbing student, for example, can't practice installing a faucet while sitting in front of a laptop, you know, but all of these classes do have a theoretical component. And, you know, and for that plumbing student, that, you know, that means things like understanding water pressure and how a shutoff valve works. So the teachers are going to go heavy on that theoretical side of the lessons while they're doing online instruction. Then when the vo-techs do move back into a hybrid instruction arrangement, more of the time that's being spent inside the school building is going to be devoted to that hands-on learning. Now, another factor, and this that I picked up from the Newcastle County vo-tech School District, which does have four schools, they're thinking about what happens if one of their career teachers is unavailable, whether it's because they contract the coronavirus or that, you know, some other issue comes up. The game plan then would be to shuttle the students in that particular teacher's subject area to another school in the district that also offers the same programming. And that way the students who are, whether the plumbing students, the electrical, whatever, can pick up their hands-on instruction in another building.
How about the logistics of all this? What are districts and schools doing to prepare teachers and families to get rolling as smoothly as possible?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the status of every district and every charter school, but I think I can do some generalizations with relative safety. You know, in the spring, some districts and some charter schools had already achieved that one-to-one status that they talk about, meaning that there's a laptop or a tablet computer available for every student, whether it's one that the student owns or one that is loaned or provided by the school in some fashion. Now, since then, since the spring, others have worked hard to reach that goal, that one-on-one goal. They've taken audits of families' needs. They've bought more laptops. They're letting students take home the devices that they previously had to keep in school. A lot of different ways to do this, but schools are getting closer to where they want to be. The other thing that they've been working on is internet access. And for families that don't have internet connections, some districts are working with Comcast to install a low-cost internet essential service in those homes. Comcast has been offering this for several years, but, you know, families don't always know about it. So school districts are working with Comcast and with the families to link them up and get that taken care of. And now, if a home is in an area where internet connections are not available, they're working with Verizon and some of the other providers to install internet hotspots in the areas of those homes so students can access the internet. Now, for teachers, the big emphasis going into this school year has been in making sure that they're familiar with the platforms that are being used for online instruction and classroom management. And I do know that a number of schools have given teachers instructions on things that they can study during the summer, and you know, some special online classes that they can have access to. And now they're really focusing on getting everybody on the same page, on the same learning platform. Schoology and Google Classroom are the two platforms that were mentioned most to me this week. And schools are picking which one to use and kind of sticking with it, having everybody in the building using that particular platform, which eliminates confusion at the school level and also makes it a lot easier for students and for their families, to the extent that the families have to get involved, so because they only have to worry about knowing how to access one particular platform for accessing lessons, for doing their homework assignments and turning them in and so on. So that's going to be easier for the school and for the students and for the parents. It's going to eliminate a lot of confusion that's associated with accessing classes and completing those assignments.
We've already seen schools and colleges opening elsewhere deal with COVID outbreaks already. What is the game plan for handling that here?
Well, you know, when you hear about what's happening at the University of North Carolina, at Notre Dame, at high schools in Georgia and Mississippi, it does give you pause. You have to wonder whether we're doing the right thing. But, you know, you can't really fault the schools for trying, and they deserve credit because they're taking a safety-first approach, and they're not trying to force a full reopening right now. Now, as we discussed last week with the private schools, just about everyone does recognize that an outbreak is inevitable, if not in their school, in another school that they're familiar with. And they know that their first step, should this occur, when a student or staff member tests positive or shows symptoms while in school, what they're going to do is they're going to call the liaison person at the Division of Public Health who is assigned to their school to talk about how to proceed, what the next step should be. You know, now, depending upon the number of cases that that school is experiencing and the possibility of whether it can spread, they're going to have to decide whether they have to shut down a classroom or perhaps an entire floor or a grade level or maybe even the entire school. Exactly what they do is going to depend upon the circumstances. Jeff Menzer, the Colonial School Superintendent, puts it this way. There is not a straight-up playbook for this. But the districts and the charters are taking some steps to control an outbreak before it arrives. Many of them are trying to break up their students into smaller groups, say 15 or so, and they would stay together all day, taking all the same classes, maybe even staying in the same classroom for all those classes. And by keeping those groups small and tightly knit, would, in theory at least, minimize the chance of spread if someone does test positive, and it would make it easier to do all that contact tracing and communications that the public health experts say is so essential.
So is anyone talking about a full return to in-person learning, or is optimism in short supply at this point?
Well, nobody is really talking about a full return to in-person learning. If you press them, you really have to push a little bit. The hopeful answer that they'll give you would be it's January, after the flu season and, you know, kind of in time to start the second semester. Right now, the focus with just about everybody that I talk to is, first of all, getting through that first week or two of online classes and then making sure that this transition that will be eventually made to hybrid learning, and with the full realization that COVID-19 caseload in the state has to go down before it occurred, to make sure that that hybrid learning transition does work out. Sally Maldonado, who's the head of the Kumba Academy Charter School, says, you know, it's important for her to maintain what she calls a stubborn optimism. Joe Jones, who's the superintendent of the Newcastle County Vo-Tech District, has kind of redefined you know, what he considers most important now. He says his big responsibility these days is bring the most certainty to every day in the most uncertain of times. And, you know, as I see it now, what's certain is that the education community is trying its best, but there are just so many unknowns that could keep them from carrying out all their plans. So, you know, you hate to say just wait and see, but yeah, just wait and see, and let's hope that that it goes as well as everybody likes, but realize that it's more than likely it's not going to be that way.
All right, Nagengast, as always, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your reporting. We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure, about this and other topics.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom.